The Guardian.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is a Science Extra podcast. Last week, the Medical Research Council and the writers' group English Pen brought together leading scientists and artists to muse on creativity. Novelist Ian McEwan shared the stage with poet Ruth Padell, medical scientist Sheena McCormack, and Nobel Prize winner Aaron Klug. Here's Ian McEwan on what differences there are, if any, in the way scientists and artists are creative in the work they do.
Ingeniousness, playfulness, and all those matters that I mentioned, you know, stubbornness and ability to focus and degree of ruthlessness or ambition, all those other drives, as well as an associative intelligence and an ability to think laterally, etc. But still, most science, I mean, you can draw on all the sort of famous apocryphal stories of scientific breakthroughs, and Einstein has one about an object falling in a window or seeing someone in a lift, or Kekulé's snake, and so on. But a great deal of science, when you look in the back pages of the Letters to Nature, are written by six or seven people. No doubt they've been very excited as a team, but one guy's doing the statistical stuff and someone's drafting it, and some hard done by postdocs, done all the donkey work and so on. So it is not quite like the poet taking a lonely, moody walk in the woods and coming back with something to recollect in tranquility. But there must be. I mean, you know, we're biologically the same thing, and they are fundamentally different forms of investigation, but they must be driven by, at root, something profoundly similar.
And you gave the anecdote about a theory being so beautiful it must be true, even though the data were kind of there or thereabouts. Mm. To what extent do you think truth and beauty go together within science?
Well, the story of Einstein and the lack of proper empirical proof for his theories comes from Steven Weinberg, so they're completely in his hands. I mean, I can't know these things at first hand, but I'm told by people who understand the mathematics that theory has a very special place. My own small experience of this is learning at school the calculus, and I thought it was breathtakingly clever and beautiful. I mean, its cleverness and its beauty seemed one, and that you could actually describe a changing system at any given point seemed to me an amazing mental somersault. And it's probably the most difficult thing I've ever got my mind round, because us know-nothing liberal arts folk then go off and there's really nothing that's very difficult to understand in all of literature. Nothing as hard as the calculus, and that's as far as I got, and there we're still in the 18th century, so maybe it was doing that gave me respect. I don't know. It could be that many things are true and very unwieldy. But I like the idea that that at least for the outsider, for the layman, one route in is into the passion of discovery in science is through its sense of wonder, its driven, organized curiosity, its sense of the economy and elegance by which one thing could explain many other things.
I think economy is very much the operative word. I mean, one thing that came out in the discussion was that, you know, a theory will be beautiful if it if lots of the pieces seem to fit together. And if lots of pieces fit together, that means lots of evidence is all pointing in the right direction, and therefore it's true. And therefore that suggests that beauty and truth do go together.
Well, especially if it works across a number of other fields. Clearly, natural selection has a whole range of different sort of specialist inputs that confirm it, so it's no longer in doubt. This is what we want it to be, but whether, you know, if we looked at all the theories that are around, especially I think in theoretical physics, and as Aaron Klug was saying, it's very unwieldy, particles popping up, generating themselves like kind of amoeba. String theory, then superstring theory, and then its elaborations had to keep bending and in the effort to accommodate objections. Then we ended up with 10 dimensions, and then 11, for reasons which I'll never know. 11 dimensions just seems to me, 6 of which are enfolded. I don't even really understand that concept at all, how a dimension can be folded. It seems to me profoundly inelegant as an outsider, but I'm told by people who understand the mathematics of string theory that it is exhilaratingly beautiful. Maybe we then have to think that beauty artistic acceptability, especially in the novel, is often to do with something very sprawling. You know, it's not tidy and elegant. I just received a new translation of Les Misérables, one of the largest novels in European literature. Great, sprawling, digressive thing. Is it a thing of beauty? Probably. So I don't know. But I think that we have a suspicion, as outsiders, as those of us who want to see science simply as part of the culture. We don't have to be composers to love music. That we can pick and choose in our science. And I think probably this is why generalization is so feeble, really. We pick and choose those bits of science which seem to explain a lot, nod at Occam's razor, and give us that thrill of economy.
Thank you very much indeed.
That was Ian McEwan on creativity. Also part of the MRC event, poet Ruth Padell read some works in progress from a collection of poems she's working on in advance of the 200th anniversary of the publication of Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species.
I just called this poem Bleak. End of September. Two lamps are lit. Covington draws a worn curtain against crepe smog. He's finishing Malthus. Shadows dance in the room like a scritch of black rain. All forms compete against others for means of their life. Breath and food, sex and light. Nature's forms don't demonstrate benevolence, divine or otherwise. Disease and pain and the world. And you talk of perfection. We are alone with our biology. New life is born from famine, extinction, death. So that's the beginning. And then there's this, then he's just moving towards thinking he's got to get married. He doesn't know who he's going to marry. He thinks he's terribly ugly. He's never been happy with how he looked. And he's beginning to realize that sexual reproduction is the key to species change, if species do change. And the one thing that he's looking for, and the one thing he puts species aside, and he starts to think about emotion. And he asks in his notebook M, what is an emotion? Blushing, chameleon, octopus, and human. Why do joy and other feelings make even grown-ups cry? London streets filthy, the rooms uncomfortable, he feels often ill. A Greek chorus of soot flakes sits on the windowsill. What goes through a man's mind when he says that he loves? Is it blind, something like sexual? Affections are an effect of the organization, as you can hardly doubt when you see the dog at Shrewsbury with her puppy. Autumn, chill city ruckus outside. He looks at his cuff, frayed and stained. He starts a new page. Inherited traits like patristic feather and bone would never be pooled. Species would never form to share the social instinct if they created offspring on their own, like charcoal sinking to the fire where it was born. What you need is a pair. Well, he goes off, of course. He strikes lucky. He marries somebody who really supports him. They're very, you know, very gay, but there is this big gulf about God, and that's there always. She knows he's moving further away. The crunch comes when their 10-year-old daughter Annie dies, and she doesn't see her die. She's pregnant again at home, but he's in Malvern, where he's taken her. And it's very, very agonizing. After Annie, he puts Christian faith behind forever. Who knows what they said to each other? On Sundays, he walks the family to church and leaves them at the door. No more smell of prayer, damp stone and polish. He sees indifference everywhere. What a book a devil's chaplain might write on nature's clumsy, wasteful, blundering works. The perpetual cull, the puzzle that is no puzzle, really, of suffering, the struggle for life. He stands around outside, chatting to the village constables, then heads into the lane to look for birds' nests, watch red ants battle black. He does believe in a divine creator still, but not hers, and not kind. A ruthless, shadowy thing, eternally going in for cruelty, elimination, waste. Rain, wind thrashes leaves in the garden, and the leaves toss, they lash the rain back. There's violence under the bright surface all the time. He wants to protect her. He sees the paradox so clear. The seeming harmony, the shining face of living things, results from what he's witnessed. Sickening and death. Each new form eternally destroyed while others take its place. All nature is at war. How could she bear his mind now in the void, in the silence of his lone walks through dawn woods? The universe we observe of intertwined competing forces has, if properly understood, precisely the properties we should expect if there is no purpose, no design, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference.
Poet Ruth Cadell there. You can find more discussion on Ian McEwan and the event in general on the latest edition of the Science Weekly podcast, available at guardian.co.uk/science. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.